we can all listen to the Sunny Side of Sports.
Great show, bro. This is Sunny Side of Sports.
Right here on the Voice of America.
Voice of America.
This is VOA Sonny Young in Washington. Happy Friday. January 17th is the birthday of the late, great Muhammad Ali, the former world heavyweight boxing champion and one of the most celebrated sports figures of the 20th century. This week on the Sunny Side of Sports, we've been looking at Ali's life and legacy. He died on June 3rd, 2016, at the age of 74, and tributes immediately poured in from all corners of the globe. One of the tributes came from Larry Holmes, one of only five men to beat Ali. My VOA colleague Shaka Sali asked Holmes how he felt after learning of Ali's death.
It hurt me because not only he was a friend of mine, but I think he was one of the greatest fighters ever lived in this world.
You happen to be one of the elite five boxers that, in fact, defeated at one time Muhammad Ali. But yet again, you happen perhaps to be a very unique individual, given that you were his former sparring partner, a friend, and of course, eventually a world heavyweight champion. What was it like to fight Muhammad Ali?
It was a good pleasure fighting Muhammad because, you know, he was my friend and he was my boss. And then I had to fight him, you know, but then it was the money thing, you know. If I beat him, I'd be the old man. If I lost, I never had anything. So, you know, my thing was not to take it hard on him because, you know, I knew how he would fight. And I knew that I could beat him, so I don't want to hurt Muhammad Ali because he is my friend. And so when we fought, you know, I told him, don't get hurt. Just don't go crazy. I did. I said, I don't want to hurt nobody. I don't want you to be hurt. And, you know, he told me, shut up and fight, you know. And I did what I had to do without hurting him, I think. I don't think I hurt him. And, you know, we remained friends because right after the fight, I went back to his dressing room and I told him, I gave him a hug and told him I love him. And he said, if you love me, why you beat me up like that, man? So, you know, he was a great man. And he wasn't angry with me or nothing like that because it was about the money. He got $10 million. And, you know, back then, that was a lot of money, you know? So he was happy. And we remained friends even after the fight.
Any particular reason, Rally, why you cried after the bout? You don't seem really to have enjoyed the fight.
I don't enjoy the fight. He was my friend. He was my boss. You know what I mean? You know, he was a guy that helped teach me how to fight. I mean, when I first went with him in 1971, I was just an amateur. I was learning how to fight. And he gave me the opportunity to come to his camp and work out with him and learn from him. He gave me that opportunity. When I worked out with Muhammad Ali for the very first time, we went to Reading, Pennsylvania. He gave me gloves and shoes, everything to box with, and he gave me the opportunity to box. And when he boxed with me, of course, he gave me the black eye, right? He gave me the black eye, and I loved it. And I said, it's okay. He wanted to put ice on my eye, and I won't let him put ice. He goes, why? I said, because I'm showing this off Muhammad Ali. Hit me in my eye. I said, this is nice. I can show it off. And, you know, he told me I was crazy, put the ice, but I never put ice. And then when I got home, I bragged about Muhammad Ali boxing me and giving me a black eye. It was a brag. Yeah, I bragged about it.
Now, knowing him the way you did, and, of course, you have to be one of the few very unique individuals that do that, do you sincerely feel, do you sincerely think that it was necessary for Muhammad Ali to fight the last two fights? I'm talking about yours and the one of Trevor Babik in the Bahamas.
Yeah, well, Trevor Babik, he didn't need to fight, but what it was about was the money. It was about the money with Ali. He started fighting for money after he couldn't beat me. He just said, I'll take a fight with money. And I didn't like that fight. I didn't think he should have took it. But again, you can't tell people what to do because, you know, the man, when I you tell him that he's the champ, I said, shut up. He can do what he want to do, so I don't say anything. Well, if he was the champ, in my opinion, he was always going to be the champ. So, you know, the Babik fight, the Trevor Babik fight, Trevor Babik didn't fight the Ali that I fought. If he did, he would have got beat.
You, again, happen to be one of the few people that interacted with him in a very special manner. What is it that during that experience, really, that you learned? What did you learn from him, and what did that interaction mean to you?
Hey, listen, I got the best jab in boxing. I had the best jab in boxing because of Muhammad Ali, because I tried to keep up with him. And when he threw the jab, I want to throw the jab. I want to beat him to the jab because everybody knew how Ali was. Everybody knew that he was a good jabber. He always jabbed right-hand combination. And I wanted to be like that, so I worked on that, to beat him to the jab. And that's why I lasted so long in boxing, because I had a good jab. Everybody had to worry about the Larry Holmes jab. And then when they worried about the Larry Holmes jab, then they had to worry about the right. And so they couldn't do both, and I was able to win the fight.
What was it like being with him in Zaire back in 1974? I'm talking about the Rambo in the jungle.
In the jungle. I was there with him. I was there with Muhammad Ali, the Rambo in the jungle, in Zaire. And he trained good. I mean, you know, people love him. Ali Boumaye. Ali Boumaye.
I didn't kill him.
Yeah. And, you know, there's all... And a lot of people that we that didn't speak good English, but they know how to say Ali Boumaye. We didn't know how to speak African, so we said Ali Boumaye. You know, we said the same thing, Ali Boumaye, Ali Boumaye. And it was neat. And people, everywhere you go, people love you. You know, they run after, they take little kids running behind the car, Ali, Ali, Ali. I mean, you know, it was mind-boggling. And you know what Ali said? He said, boy, he said, you're home. This is home, man. This is what our people look like. That's what we look like. And you know, he was very proud to be in Zaire. And I was just as proud as he was, because I was with the greatest fighter of all time.
Any particular reason why the people preferred Ali to the champion himself, George Foreman?
George Foreman, though, it was okay boxer, but you know, they didn't like George Foreman. I mean, you know, because Ali, they loved Ali, they didn't like George Foreman, because George Foreman wasn't no Muhammad Ali. Everywhere Ali go, people go with him, but George, they didn't do that with George. That's okay, because I didn't like George either.
I see. Have you been to Africa, Lale, since 1974?
I did not go to Zaire, but I've been in different parts of Africa already. Yeah, I've been in different parts.
What is it like to be a world heavyweight champion of the world? And you were for many years.
Well, it was an honor to be the heavyweight champion of the world. It's an honor to work, to represent black fighters that could be able to do something. It was great to honor white fighters if they work hard enough, they can be something, you know. It means something when anybody that works hard as I work can be anything that they want to be. You know, whether you're black, whether white, or orange, or green color, I don't care. If you work at something, you can always be that. Ali was living proof that if you work at it, you can be it. And he was one example. He immortalized boxing, and he would go down as one of the greatest fighters of all time. And I'm just glad to say that I was one of the guys who helped him become one of the great fighters of all time.
That's former world heavyweight boxing champion Larry Holmes reflecting on the life and legacy of Muhammad Ali. Ali was born January 17th, 1942, and he died June 3rd, 2016. And Larry Holmes was talking with my VOA colleague Shaka Sali during a 2016 broadcast of Shaka's Straight Talk Africa show. I'm Sonny Young, and you're listening to the Sunny Side of Sports on the Voice of America. A top official of the Nigeria Football Federation says the NFF has signed a new TV deal to put the country's league back on air. Shehu Diko is the second vice president of the Nigeria Football Federation. He's also the chairman of the league management company, which oversees Nigeria's professional football league. In an interview with Iron Mike Mbonye, Diko talked about the new broadcasting arrangement.
We are very close. all the preparations is ongoing, but I need to make it very clear, it's not just about OGT per se. Part of the deal that we signed is to get an investment and support to the league so that I can keep going as a business concern, which that has started happening. And then the second part of the transaction is to also resolve the issue of the production. We need to find a way to produce all the games, or at least most of the games that are being played. Which platforms are we going to now distribute the games? So the first platform we are looking at is the OTT, which already work has been done. The app is being developed. It's already on the Play Store, and the Apple Store is coming on board. And then already we have an arrangement with one of the mobile companies, Nam Mobile, who are coming on board to offer special data packages that will take the OTT. Then, so what will make the production? We'll first start with the OTT, and then we will see which other platforms also we can put some games on. We'll have to put some games maybe on the free-to-air, maybe even on cable. So at least we are very close to that. But you know, the first investment is the production. It's not just about putting it on the distribution. You have to produce before you distribute. And that is the bane of the problem, that people don't understand. So we are actually very, very close. At any moment, we will be on air.
Can you tell us some of the obstacles or challenges to the growth of the MPFL?
There are a lot of things, but you know, fundamentally football and even sports is driven by money. Everybody knows about that. And then the money business in sport, especially football, is driven by broadcast, by TV. And broadcast is also driven by the production. You have to have the content first. If you don't have the content, you can't broadcast anything, you can't distribute anything. So it's a step by step. And then also in Nigeria, for us to be able to produce the content, we have to also have the infrastructure challenges. And I can tell you the football cannot exist in the absence of the normal infrastructure challenges that we have in the country. To produce a game here in Nigeria is quite a huge investment. It costs a lot of money to produce even one game. It costs a lot of $30,000, $40,000 for this one game because of the infrastructure deficit. That's the numbers that we are seeing from the people doing the production. So that's the major challenges. The moment we can be able to resolve the production issue to build the games, and we had a platform to commercialize the game, once the money comes, then there will be a lot of investment that will go into the clubs, that will go into the infrastructure for the facilities, and of course, into servicing the players who are the key party to hold all the transactions. So it's a whole chain of issues that need to be resolved before you can be able to get the best league we are trying to put in play.
What is the NFF, the Nigerian Football Federation, and the league management company doing to assist our clubs do well at the continental level? Sir, you'll agree with me that some of our clubs in recent times have not been doing well at the continental level.
We always engage the clubs if they are playing the continent. I can tell you the clubs always have a representation from the NFF working with them. They have representation from the league working with them anytime they are in the continent, trying to make sure the logistics is okay, trying to make sure all the rules are okay, trying to make sure all the facilitation are okay, all the things that they need to do, because you know the NFF are more experienced in international games because they're playing games every day. So we have people attached to them, giving them to do that so they can be able to be comfortable and deliver the result. In fact, at some point when the league used to have some available resources, we used to even support the clubs with resources. And we also, as the league body, we used to work with the clubs to prepare. For example, now you see a club looking for a player at that club, but the club will say, no, we can't give you the player. So we used to intervene to see how we can bring the two clubs together for the interest of the nation, so that the good players can go to those teams, and so that they can be able to present the good teams in the continent.
That's Shehu Diko, the second vice president of the Nigeria Football Federation, and he spoke with Iron Mike Mbonye on the telephone from Abuja, Nigeria.
Sporting greetings. This is Shehu Diko, the second vice president of Nigeria Football Federation and chairman of League Management Company. You are listening to the Sony Side of Sports on the Voice of America. Thank you very much.
What are the root causes of conflict in Libya? Why does the leader of the internationally recognized Government of National Accord, Fayez al-Sarraj, face a challenge from General Khalifa Haftar, who has the backing of Saudi Arabia, the UAE, and Egypt? Host Carol Castiel and VOA Middle East reporter Mohammed al-Shinawi talk with Libya observer Jason Pack of the Middle East Institute. Listen this Saturday and Sunday on Press Conference USA.
I'm Sonny Young, and you're listening to the Sunny Side of Sports on the Voice of America. Samson Omale joins us now with a package of African sports news. And Sampson says he'll be tipping off with African basketball.
Sporty greetings to you, Sonny. Algeria became the latest team to advance to the FIBA AfroBasket 2021 qualifiers round, despite a 99-90 home defeat against Cape Verde on Thursday. And thanks to their 79-67 win on Wednesday, Algeria closed the two-game series with a 169-166 win on aggregate, and they will now join Nigeria, Mali, and Rwanda in Group D, whose action takes place next window from November the 23rd to December the 1st at venues yet to be determined. In athletics news, former world junior 800 meters champion Alfred Kipketer is the latest Kenyan athlete to be provisionally suspended by the Athletics Integrity Unit for doping violations. The 23-year-old, a finalist in the 800 meters at the 2016 Olympic Games in Rio de Janeiro, allegedly failed to make himself available for out-of-competition drugs tests. Kipketer, who also won the World Youth title in 2013 and reached the final of the 2015 International Association of Athletics Federations World Championships in Beijing, will not be allowed to compete again until the case is fully investigated, leaving his participation at this year's Olympic Games in Tokyo in doubt. In handball news, Tunisia is hosting the 2020 Men's Handball African Championship, also known as the African Cup of Nations, which is underway in Tunisia and will last until Sunday, the 26th of January. A total of 16 nations will play 52 games, initially in a preliminary round featuring four groups of four teams each. The overall winners of the championship will book their place directly to the Tokyo 2020 Olympic Games, while the second and third place teams qualifying through to the 2020 Olympic qualification tournaments to be held in April. Kenya is one of the participating countries, and Peter Mwati is the coach of the Kenya handball team.
The Confederation of African Body classification, the ranking, it puts Kenya in a better position, and this is because of the previous international matches that we have played, and we have been able to give our best in it.
I am Samson Omale in Abuja, Nigeria.
Of the Nigerian national men's rugby team. You're listening to the Sunny Side of Sports on the Voice of America.
Hello, this is Heather Maxwell, host of Music Time in Africa. Join me every Saturday and Sunday for an hour of awesome African music. Wake up. Like to stay on top of new music trends, breakout artists, new releases? Maybe you just love the classic styles and the artists of the past. Or simply the sound and feel of a good beat. Whatever your pleasure, you can get it every week. Right here on Music Time in Africa. So join me on your local FM station, Saturdays and Sundays at 1500 and 2000 UTC.
Thanks, Heather. We look forward to your next Music Time in Africa show. I'm Sonny Young, and you're listening to the Sunny Side of Sports on the Voice of America. Now let's go to Pakistan, where a group of dedicated young women in Karachi has been working to beat the odds and change the culture around them. The women are doing it by cycling. VOA's Aisha Tanzim reports from Karachi.
Riding a bicycle sounds like a very ordinary activity in many parts of the world. Not here, and not for these girls. This is Liari, a conservative neighborhood in Pakistan's largest city, Karachi. Women here are mostly absent from public life. So when a Germany-sponsored NGO called Liari Girls Cafe helped a group of young girls learn how to ride a bicycle, locals were shocked. Initially, the resistance was strong. People would pass foul comments. Some local madrasas even sent young students to throw stones at them.
Sometimes the criticism was so harsh that we felt disturbed and mentally tortured, but we did not give up and continue our journey.
Every Sunday, these girls pick up their bikes and take them to an empty parking lot to practice. For them, it is more than a simple sport. It is a form of activism.
I belong to an area where girls are often suppressed. I did not want my daughters to go through what I went through as a child. I started cycling myself so I can bring my daughters with me.
Not a single one of these young women owns a bike. The 30 bikes they share among themselves have been mostly donated by local authorities or the German consulate in Karachi. Ultimately, these girls are hoping to change attitudes. They want cycling to become normal for females. They want to be able to do it in their daily lives, to go to school or to work. Their hopes for the future are high, but for now, this stretch of road, empty on a Sunday morning, is the only space they have to express their passion. Aisha Tanzeem, VOA News, Karachi.
I'm VOA's Sonny Young, and you're listening to The Sunny Side of Sports on The Voice of America. Turning to tennis, Australian Open organizers are keeping their fingers crossed that they'll have smoke-free skies ahead of the year's first major tournament, which begins Monday in Melbourne. Australia has been dealing with deadly bushfires for months, and the smoke has sometimes blanketed Melbourne and other cities with a thick haze. There were cool temperatures and clear skies in Melbourne on Friday when the Environmental Protection Agency downgraded the forecast for air quality in the area from very poor to moderate. Now, the tennis organizers in Melbourne have already been severely criticized for letting qualifying matches continue on Tuesday and Wednesday earlier this week, with noxious smoke shrouding Melbourne Park. Several players suffered breathing problems, with Slovenia's Dalila Jakupovic forced to retire after a coughing fit. Britain's Johanna Konta is seated 12th among the women at the upcoming Australian Open. She plays her opening match on January 21st against the Tunisian Onis Jabeur. Konta says she's not sure if she'll play if the weather conditions resemble the conditions of earlier this week when there was lots of smoke around the tennis courts. On Friday, the Australian Open organizers released full details of their air quality policy. A discussion over play being suspended would be held when the pollution exceeded set levels detected by the monitoring stations at Melbourne Park. If play was suspended on the three stadium courts, the roof of the arena would be closed until the air quality reached a suitable level. Torrential downpours in affected areas since midweek have helped contain the bushfires, but many still blaze, with the possibility of more smoke being blown towards Melbourne. On Wednesday, many of the best players in tennis, including defending Australian Open champions Novak Djokovic and Naomi Osaka, participated in a Rally for Relief charity event to raise money for the bushfire relief effort. Rafael Nadal and Roger Federer also participated in the Rally for Relief, and they announced they had pledged $250,000 each to the initiative. And that wraps up the January 17th edition, the Muhammad Ali birthday edition of The Sunny Side of Sports. Thanks to Voice of America producer Bill Werkinger. Thanks also to VOA engineer PJ Elliott. And thank you for tuning in. I'm VOA's Sonny Young in Washington, and that's the sunny side of sports.
I get it.
Hello, this is Peter Clotty, host of Nightline Africa. Please join us every Saturday and Sunday at 16 and 18 hours UTC. Nightline Africa is VOA's Africa's weekend show that provides news, features, and entertainment news about Africa and the world. Tune in. You will be glad you did. I guarantee it.
Want to relax, unwind, or charge up? Then listen to Music Time in Africa this weekend. It'll do all that for you and more. I'm Heather Maxwell. I know good music. And Africa is my passion. Join me every Saturday and Sunday for 1 hour of commercial-free Pan-African music of the highest caliber. You get great music, music news, and amazing artist interviews from rising stars to superstars. This listen will take you places. So do it. Join me for Music Time in Africa, your weekend destination.
The Voice of America's Global News Program, International Edition, brings you an in-depth look at the biggest news stories of the day. Nobody covers the world more comprehensively than VOA. Our correspondents gather the news and the views of the most seasoned experts on international issues. Tune in Monday through Friday at 3:30 and 17:05 UTC on The Voice of America.
The 62nd Annual Grammy Awards Show is coming up. To celebrate, Border Crossings will play songs from the winners of the 2019 American Music Awards to refresh you on some of last year's best tracks. Tune in to hear from your favorite artists like Post Malone, BTS, and Taylor Swift, January 23rd on The Voice of America.
This is Science in a Minute.
Astronomers at the California Institute of Technology's Zwicky Transient Facility, or ZTF, have discovered the first asteroid to orbit entirely within the orbit of Venus. Called 2020 AV2, the space rock is classified by scientists as an Atiris asteroid, which are objects whose orbits fall completely within Earth's orbit. With this discovery, there are now 21 of these Atiris asteroids circling the Sun. Actually, 2020 AV2 is also considered the first known Vatira asteroid, with a V meaning Venus. Caltech's George Helu, executive director of the IPAC Astronomy Center at Caltech and a co-investigator at ZTF, says the asteroid must have traveled toward Venus from further out in the solar system, and if it leaves its current orbit, will probably crash into Venus or Mercury. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
VOA brings you the best in African music on the African Beat. African Beat showcases the latest and the greatest of contemporary African music, from bobo music to hip life, bonga flavor to soukous, Afrobeat to ndombolo and makossa to kwaito. The African Beat on VOA has it all. And it's happening right here, Mondays through Fridays at 09:05 and 20:05 UTC, right after the international news.